Hello, and welcome to the Monday, January 13th edition of Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm Joan Pardis. I'm your Monday host. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer. We've got a great show. We'll talk about Tuesday's Mudroom presentation. We'll talk with Matt Felix about CBJ's Healthy Indicators Report. Michael Patterson will be here to talk about his experiences as a smoker, and we'll celebrate National Mentoring Month with Big Brothers Big Sisters. All that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian rock musician Neil Young has launched a series of concerts to help raise money for a First Nation in its effort to fight development of Alberta oil sands. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Young has been critical of Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government for supporting development.
At a news conference in Toronto, Young launched a blistering attack against the Harper government. He said he was shattered after recently visiting an industrial site at Fort McMurray, Alberta, an oil sands development he compared to the devastation of Hiroshima after the atomic bomb. Young said the Harper government is ignoring science and trading integrity for money.
I want my grandchildren to grow up and look up and see a blue sky and have dreams that their grandchildren are going to do great things. And I don't see that today in Canada. I see a government in completely out of control. Money is number one. Integrity isn't even on the map.
Young was speaking just hours before his Sunday evening concert in Toronto. He was joined on stage by representatives of the Athabasca Chippewyan First Nation. The stage also included a wooden First Nations figure, and behind it all, as a massive backdrop, a red banner reading, "Honor the Treaties." The Athabasca Chippewyan First Nation represents a community living about 120 miles downstream of the current oil sands development. It's in a fight to protect its traditional territory from further industrialization. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Prime Minister said Canada's natural resources sector is and has always been a fundamental part of the country's economy, and projects are only approved when they are deemed safe for Canadians and the environment. Young's tour is set to travel to Winnipeg and Regina before wrapping up next weekend in Calgary. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A northern Wisconsin band of Ojibwe will continue environmental research in a proposed iron ore mining area with or without the state's approval. Mike Simonson reports.
The Lacouture Band has been surveying flora and fauna around a five-acre temporary village since May. Last month, the Department of Natural Resources notified LCO that they don't believe treaties give the tribe the right to grant itself a scientific research permit. DNR attorney Quinn Williams says this is unprecedented.
We've never seen the tribes issue themselves a permit, and it's not clear to us that that's something that is specified in their off-reservation model code.
But LCO Chairman Mick Isham says they not only have the right, but there is a sense of urgency for them to continue their research.
Especially in light of the fact that a mine may be going there and destroying the whole environment, you know, cutting all the trees and the whole bit up there. It's essential that we do it now before it's all gone.
Isham says they don't need the state's permission for this permit. They just need to consult with the state. He also says the state is stuck on the issue that the project is about illegal camping.
It's like trying to fit a square peg into the round hole. We are not camping. We're out there doing legitimate research.
In a letter from the DNR to Isham Wednesday, they again questioned LCO's right to do off-reservation research. But Williams says the state only wants to talk.
It's always better to sit down and try to work things out first before you jump right into either accusations of illegal activities or threatening to take someone to court.
The LCO project has four people living in two wigwams in the Iron County Forest next to the proposed mining area. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is set to open a new food distribution center this week. Located in Collinsville, the center will provide monthly food to hundreds of Native families. The site also creates five jobs in the community. The tribe operates seven food distribution centers and five tailgate sites in its 14-county jurisdiction. In January 1923, Ira Hayes was born in Arizona. The Native American became famous after he helped raise the U.S. flag on Iwo Jima during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm your host, Joan Partis, for Mondays. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show. I gave you the lineup of the show, and I forgot Latitude 58, the theater company. We'll have a representative there here in the studio later on as well. So we've got a packed house today. I want to do a little weather for you. I'm sorry, we've received our allotment for snow this weekend. No more snow. No, I'm only kidding, kind of. Numerous rain showers for the rest of the week mixed with snow. So if you want snow, go up to Eagle Crest. There's plenty of it out there, and there's plenty out the road. So in the studio right now, we have Aaron Hansen and Clint Farr. They're here to talk about Mudrooms. Mudrooms is happening tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Northern Lights Church. And Aaron, you have done a mudroom, so can you tell us a little bit about what Mudrooms is?
Sure. I mean, I think first off, it's just a really neat opportunity to listen to your neighbors tell stories and, you know, learn something about these people that you see every day. But essentially, Mudrooms is it's a storytelling event, and there's seven people who tell stories based off of a theme. And, you know, the stories either are directly related or slightly related to the theme, but they're all told by amateur storytellers. I mean, some professionals, I think, do come in and tell stories, but it's a really neat mix. And so it's neat to hear seven different, totally different voices. And the stories are 7 minutes long, maximum. So it goes pretty fast. And yeah.
Seven people, 7 minutes.
Yeah. Seven people, and 7 minutes, $7.
Yeah. Oh, wow. There we go. It is the seventh. So you have done one mudroom. So you told a story last year.
I did.
And
yes.
Then tomorrow the theme is grace. Is that correct? And you'll be telling another story?
I will be telling another story. And sort of the funny thing for me is both my mother and my father have told stories at mudrooms.
Oh, my.
I think my mom's told two stories. And then my dad told a story this fall about my grandparents, my grandpa and grandma Hansen, who I will also be talking about tomorrow. So if you go to Mudrooms, you're going to find out a lot about the Hansons.
And the six other people as well.
And the six other people as well, yeah.
Because these storytelling events are definitely, they're real stories. So people are sharing snippets of their lives.
Yeah, and I think the other really neat thing about it is the way it's structured, it's not people reading sort of composed pieces. It's supposed to feel really from the heart, kind of off the cuff, like you're sitting down at a table and somebody's telling you a story.
Did I ever tell you about the time?
Yeah, exactly.
So this is the third year, so I'm going to ask some questions to Clint Farr here. He is a storyteller himself, a writer, and he's also on the board.
Correct.
And
yep.
So it's 3 years, and every time I've gone, they are packed.
They
so
are
It's wildly
packed.
Successful.
It is wildly successful. It's been a great run each year. We had to actually move venues this year over to Northern Light Church because the previous venue here downtown we couldn't fit everybody that wanted to come and see it. So that's been a nice sort of tale of success, is the need for a larger place. And yes, we have a few between 100 and 200 folks show up to listen to the stories. And it's a lot of fun to hear people's stories. I think what Mudrooms does, it allows us to see what people truly value. You rarely hear stories about stuff people buy. It's about their experiences that enrich us, and that's what you hear about. And I really love that part about it. And travel comes into play a lot, it seems, in mudrooms. But our experiences or our grandparents' experiences. You know, that often happens too. It's not about them so much as a member of their family or a friend they once knew. And that's really fun to hear, too. Other people's experiences can be just as enriching.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I was just thinking about what you're saying. It's not about what people buy, because I think the first time I went, it was the holiday theme last year, and it was Christmas, and it was gifts or something like that, and nobody talked about presence, except maybe in a larger sense, right. You know, like as a conduit to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting. So, and it's also amazing to me that 3 years, it's wildly successful. When something happens in Juneau that Juneau wants, it's just people just gobble it up. They mm-hmm. love it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the regularity of mudrooms. So tomorrow it's 7 o'clock at Northern Lights, but yeah. It happens every month. Is that correct?
Once a month through the winter months. And the idea is it's a fundraiser. There is a board, but it's not an official nonprofit. The board is very loosey-goosey. It's just a group of people who want to make sure this continues. The money that is raised by the $7 suggested fee goes to local nonprofits. This year, in fact, it's been so successful we decided to go with two nonprofits. The first four have been going to Discovery Southeast. The second four shows, so the shows beginning next month, will go to Big Brothers Big Sisters. So, you know, two very worthy groups. And
great.
And it's been, like I said, it's, like you said, it's been wildly successful.
Okay. So if people want to, let's say they're listening and saying, okay, I'm finally going to tell a story. And that's mm-hmm. the voice I used when a board member asked me. So maybe you'll be much more forceful about telling the story in front of people. But if they want to, how do they do that?
Probably the best way is to go to mudrooms.org and go to the sign up page there, and we actually need people for the Deception show. Ooh. In April. Very cool. And we have a spot left, it looks like, in the Close Calls thing for the last in May. So there's looks like there's a few spots still open, but even if you just want to put your name into the hat, you can do that with an online sign-up form on the mudrooms.org.
Okay. Yeah. And it happens every month. And is it a certain day each month, too, so people are listening?
We're alternating between the, I think, second Tuesday and second Wednesday each month. So this will be the Tuesday, and then February's will be on a Wednesday. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That way people who have Tuesday or Wednesday commitments can go.
Do you guys still need any musicians?
Looks like we need a musician for the March theme, wildlife, yeah.
Wildlife.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you, I'm going to paint a little picture. You walk into the Northern Lights Church, there's mm-hmm. music happening, there's food, there's goodies, there's all your neighbors, there's coffees, there's people, there are people taking the money, then you go sit down and the show begins, and there's a little intro for each person, and then you're off and running.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. and I just want to mention the music. As much as I've been blown away by the stories, the musicians have been fantastic
mm-hmm.
this year. Unfortunately, I can't remember any of their names. You can go online and go see who played, but the music has been great.
That sounds so great.
That's another reason to go.
Okay, so that's mudrooms.org, and Erin will be telling one of her stories tomorrow in Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for coming in.
Okay.
And check it out
so
tomorrow, Northern Lights, 7 p.m.
Okay.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 13th of January, 2014. It's the birthday of Laurie Moore, born 1957, Glens Falls, New York. She said of her childhood, there was acting and dressing up. We'd play music and write crappy songs. We'd draw and paint and fancy ourselves as artistic. It was part of being a girl in the 60s that you were creative. She won a short story prize from 17 magazine when she was 19, and so she felt obliged to send them everything she had ever written. She said, they couldn't get rid of me. I was like a stalker. I sent them everything, and of course they didn't want anything more from me. She told her parents about winning the prize and found out that they had both wanted to be writers themselves. Her father went up in the attic and brought down stories that he'd once sent to the New Yorker. Her mother admitted that she'd given up journalism for nursing. Laurie Moore published her first book, a collection of stories called Self-Help. The book was received well, published two novels after that, Anagrams and Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, as well as a short story collection, Birds of America. Her most recent book is A Gate at the Stairs. And it's the birthday of Horatio Alger, Jr., born in Chelsea, Massachusetts, 1832, the author of dime novels for boys, which followed a simple formula. A young boy living in poverty manages to find success and happiness by working hard and never giving up. Rag to riches, pluck and luck, as Alger said. But tastes changed. His books didn't sell so well. He tried to make them more violent, but his income dried up, and he died in near poverty in 1899, Horatio Alger, Jr. Here's a poem for today, a little music hall verse from England in the mid-19th century by Harry Clifton, entitled Polly Perkins. I am a broken-hearted milkman, in grief I'm arrayed, through keeping of the company of a young servant maid, who lived on board and wages, the house to keep clean, in a gentleman's family near Paddington Green. She was as beautiful as a butterfly, and as proud as a queen, was pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green. She'd an ankle like an antelope and a step like a deer, a voice like a blackbird so mellow and clear. Her hair hung in ringlets so beautiful and long, I thought that she loved me, but I found I was wrong. When I'd rattle in a morning and cry, "Milk below!" at the sound of my milk cans, her face she would show, with a smile upon her countenance and a laugh in her eye. If I thought she'd have loved me, I'd have laid down to die. When I asked her to marry me, she said, "Oh, what stuff!" and told me to drop it, for she'd had quite enough of my nonsense. At the same time, I'd been very kind, but to marry a milkman she didn't feel inclined. Oh, the man that has me must have silver and gold, a chariot to ride in and be handsome and bold. His hair must be curly as any watch spring, and his whiskers as big as a brush for clothing. The words that she uttered went straight through my heart. I sobbed and I sighed, and straight did depart, with a tear on my eyelid as big as a bean, bidding goodbye to Polly and Paddington Green. In 6 months she married, this hard-hearted girl, but it was not a viscount, and it was not an earl, it was not a baronight, but a shade or two wuss. It was a bow-legged conductor of a two-penny bus. A music hall verse by Harry Clifton about pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Please join me this coming Monday at 7 p.m. for Mind Over Matter. A special guest and I will have a conversation about the challenges and joys of living life fully and of living a life with meaning. So tune in to KTOO this Monday at 7 p.m.
That's tonight at 7 p.m. Dr. Elaine Schroeder will have on her show Dr. Lauren Hine, and they are going to be talking about what's being done to make your food, water, and air safer and how you could limit your exposure to toxins. Dr. Lauren Hine is an environmental engineer and a leader in the field of green chemistry. And Dr. Schroeder and Dr. Hine will chat about that tonight. And Dr. Schroeder's show is fantastic. It's 7 p.m. tonight. Right now it's 3:18 p.m. in Alaska's capital city. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, 6:30 p.m., the Juneau Human Rights Commission will meet, and that's going to be at the City Hall Conference Room, and that is room 224, so that is open to the public. Here in the studio with me right now is Matt Felix, and Matt Felix is here to talk about a healthy indicator report, a little snapshot of what's going on in Juneau's health. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's community health, yeah.
Okay. So tell us, it's a big report, but tell us, you know, what did you find?
Some of the highlights.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to start out by telling the Assembly that Juneau is a very, very healthy place to live. And I said very, very on purpose. It's the number one healthy city in the state of Alaska. And it's not too far off national benchmarks for being a healthy city. So, therefore, it's in the top percentile of counties or areas in the United States in terms of being a quality city in terms of healthcare. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it is fantastic, and it's you know, there's a number of reasons for it, but community health is a broad spectrum approach to looking at a community and its health. And it isn't just about infectious diseases or broken arms or, you know, fatalities in an automobile and stuff like that. It's, you know, a poverty rate for children, clean water, clean air, how many mammograms done a year in a particular community. So it's a pretty broad spectrum approach at looking at positive things about healthcare in a community. And also, it spends a lot of time, unfortunately, on the negative things, because the purpose of this report is to give a community and community health planners an indication of how to make it a better community to live in, a healthier community to live in. So it does focus a lot on the problems in the community.
Right. So overall, we're a healthy community, but what are the problems that we're facing?
Overall, we're a superior healthy community. We're a very healthy community. I mean, you know, if I could spend a little time on that.
Sure.
I mean, our water is so clean that it's cleaner than the stuff you buy on a plastic jug. It's sort of silly to buy a plastic jug of water unless you want the container. But, I mean, we've got a wonderful infrastructure, health infrastructure around here for our size. Our hospital is, you know, an amazing hospital for a community of, or even with a target population regionally of 50,000. So that's the reason why we're so well rated by national surveys in terms of health. But we do have problems. We do, and we can improve on, you know, and that's what the majority of this report's about. And the primary one is drug and alcohol abuse and all the diseases associated with those two things. And the community's aware. There were two surveys done in Juneau, one in 2005, the Compass survey, and another, the McDowell survey in 2010. And they had people in the community identified alcohol and drug abuse as the main issues, too. So the community's aware of the main issue. But we do have a high rate of hepatitis C. The whole state has a high rate of hepatitis C, and we're no different there. And an awful high rate of sexually transmitted diseases. You know, as a community health indicator report, it considers, I don't know if we call it a health problem, but certainly something to be aware of in a report like this is that we're so rapidly aging. We are one of the fastest, if not the fastest, communities in the United States in terms of our aging population. And it's not because we, you know, have an in-migration of old people who want to retire here like Arizona and Florida, but we have a lot of people who are retiring here when they retire. And that, for a community health system, is really a big alert, because that's going to impact our healthcare system here tremendously, both financially and in terms of needs and in terms of special kinds of care that we're going to need.
Right.
So those are some of the main findings.
Right. And Matt's presenting his findings tonight to the committee as a whole at the City Assembly meeting tonight at 5 p.m.
And that's 6.
At 6 p.m., sorry.
6 p.m.
And that's at the City Chambers. So, Matt, so what you just said as far as the problems facing Juneau, they don't sound surprising. Was there anything that you found that you went, whoa, look at this. This is really unusual.
Well, the rapid pace of aging was, I think, just mind-blowing. I mean, it is really taking statisticians back, because, I mean, we're just zooming to an aging population.
And the reason that's not surprising to me is because on the show we've had people who have talked about this, and they're trying, as the city as a whole is trying to do some planning of what to do with all the elderly that just won't leave Juneau.
Right. it's a nice place to live, really, consider everything. There's a great infrastructure for old elders here. There's a great health infrastructure, and sometimes people are even attracted here because they have children that live here, adult children that live here. So that's impacting that as well.
Right.
I think one of the biggest findings, it's not really a biggest finding. I suspected it for a long time, but I think a hidden finding is that Because the community is willing to tax itself, we have a sales tax, and a lot of communities in Alaska don't, not very many, and because we have an assembly over the last, a local government over the last, both assembly and government itself, over the last 30 years, willing to support a healthcare infrastructure and a social service infrastructure, the results of being number one in the state in terms of a healthy community is not surprising, but it sort of is when it comes up like this. It's thrown in your face. I guess another really surprising thing is that we're in the top percentile of counties in the United States. I mean, we're some of the healthiest places to live is up here. One of the major studies I'm presenting tonight is the University of Wisconsin county by county comparison of communities, and they use a myriad of data to compare counties, and they also set benchmarks for the ideal healthy county, and we come so surprising that we come close to a lot of those benchmarks. I mean, there's a few areas in the 30 or so or 35 I think benchmarks that they use to measure us, but a lot of them were where, of course, we supersede the state averages, but we also come very close to those national benchmarks, and that's really surprising. I mean, I guess it's because if you work in behavioral health like I do, you see a lot of problems, and if you're on a city, you see a lot of people come to you for needs and funding. So it's sort of you don't get the objective view, but when you take and look at the research, the objective view is we're just a wonderful place to live in terms of health.
That's wonderful to hear, because so many of us have chosen Juneau to live because of quality of life, It's just really nice to know that the numbers say the same thing as well.
Yeah.
But we obviously have our issues that we have to deal with.
Yes.
As I said, I've interviewed people that are really looking at the 10-year, 20-year, 20 years out, and what is the city going to do with that elderly population?
Yeah.
So that's great. So tonight, Matt Felix will be presenting his report at 6 p.m. Matt, thank you so much for the service that you've done for Juneau. And also, you're retired now, but I want to thank you for your service. And also thank you for putting together this report for us and compiling it and presenting it to the Assembly.
See you tonight.
Okay, great. Thanks. Bye.
Who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm your Monday host, Joan Partis. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. It's 3:30 p.m. in Alaska's capital city. We have two guests in the studio right now. We have Kristen Cox and Michael Patterson. I'm sorry about that. And Kristen is here. She's representing NCADD. Before we even go further, Kristen, thank you for coming here. Can you tell us what NCADD is?
NCADD is the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, and I am the tobacco prevention coordinator there.
Great. And so there's a landmark. Today is a landmark of sorts. You want to tell us about
Well,
it?
It's this month is a 50-year anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report on tobacco and that it's actually harmful to human health. So we wanted to mark that event. And in the last 50 years, the tobacco smoking rates have come down 50%, which is really a big decrease, and we're very proud of that. However, tobacco still is the leading cause of preventable death, disability, and disease in the United States. So it's really still the number one cause of death.
Of preventable death.
Yes. Actually, probably
death, period.
Yeah, I mean,
the big reaper, the whole thing.
It causes more, it's motor vehicle accidents, HIV, AIDS, homicide and suicide all put together. Tobacco kills more people than all of those causes together.
Wow.
And so I have with me Michael Patterson. He's 58 years old, and he was a smoker for 48 years. He was chosen by the CDC to be one of five nationwide spokespeople for their tobacco campaign.
What's the CDC?
The Center for Disease Control. And so these people have very powerful messages. And sadly, of those five, three of them are still with us, and two of them are already deceased.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, it's unfortunate, but they, you know, because they were able to tell their stories and really influence people before their death, and that's, you know, really meant a lot to them. And Michael is here to tell his story.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming in, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we talked a little bit on the break. We don't have a tremendous amount of time, but we do want to hear your story. What is the story? What is the message that you're sharing with people?
Like she was sharing, you know, I smoked for 48 years, and ironically, I started at age 9, and I also discovered that I started when the Surgeon General's report came out.
Ironically, right.
Ironically, and, you know, I pretty much smoked all my life, and it wasn't until, you know, I was diagnosed with a COPD and emphysema that it was brought out that that Alaska Natives basically run twice the risk. They have the highest rate of cancer of any nationality in the United States, and the United States has about every nationality on Earth.
Oh.
But it's because we don't have the genetic makeup to fight, you know, and I think it's sad that that information wasn't out there. It might have caused me to think a little bit differently about things.
Right. That's the first time I've heard that.
And Alaska right. Natives smoke at twice the rate.
Right.
And they smoke at a higher rate of any ethnic group in the whole country, which is really heartbreaking tragedy because tobacco, unlike the tribes in the lower 48, is not a part of the Alaska Native tradition. And they really didn't start smoking in great numbers until the Vietnam War, when a lot of the Alaska Native men went to war and they came back with this habit, and now, you know, it's really a problem in the community.
Right. And their genetic makeup is such that they're more susceptible to
right.
at twice the rate, you're saying. That's
yeah.
really, that's powerful information.
You know, and also one of the things that kept me smoking, you know, when I was in school, people obviously came to school and warned us that tobacco use could be harmful, and they showed us pictures of black lungs and a lot of different things to try to discourage us. And, you know, that kind of turns your mind and stomach a little bit, but you know, it didn't really touch me, and I kept thinking when I was that young was that nothing was going to happen until I was an old person ready to die, so it really didn't matter. So I really didn't have to listen or worry about it, you know, and obviously when I decided that, I really was misinformed and didn't know much because, you know, there are other things you can get besides cancer. Emphysema and COPD aren't considered to be cancer, but they're just as hideous. And, you know, obviously I have it before I'm an old person ready to die. And so, you know, there's no turning back the clock at this point. And so knowing that I have only a short time left in my life, you know, I've had to look at what I wanted to do with the time I had left. And the only thing I could see that I wanted to do was try to stop as many people as possible from having to experience suffocating to death. I mean, there's nothing more terrifying, you know, and when I made that decision, I never knew I was going to be a father. I never knew I was going to be a grandfather. I never knew the level of the intensity of love that I would share with my grandchildren. And so when they look at me with that tremendous love in their eyes that they have for me, you know, it breaks my heart knowing that I'm going to break their hearts, that I'm going to create an event in their life that, you know, it's going to be tragic, you know, And I hope that there are other people out there that are grandparents or parents would think about this now and maybe do something to stop this because they don't ever want to find out what it feels like to be where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I just want to reintroduce our guest tonight. It's Michael Patterson. He's been a smoker for 48 years of his 58 years, and this month is the 50th anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report on tobacco, and Michael is a speaker who's going out, and he's chosen that this is what he wants to do. He wants to share his story to help prevent tobacco use with young people, everybody, actually, you know. That. So, Michael, thank you so much for what you're doing and choosing to do this. It's a horrible story. And I smoked as a youth, too, and I'm not sure how many people didn't smoke as a youth. And the point is, it's a horrible habit. It's really addictive, and it's really hard to quit.
Yeah, it used to be glamorized tremendously when I was growing up, and luckily today it's not. You know, and because I was chosen by CDC, I've been given an opportunity, you know, not only to do this commercial, and it was a very powerful commercial that was done. I'm also being invited to speak in schools all over Alaska and whatnot. And you know, that's where my focus is to speak to the youth today. And I know so many of them are thinking the way I was thinking when I was young, that it made it okay for me to keep smoking and tell them, no, you know, this is a mistake. This is tragically wrong. And this is why. And I've been very successful, you know, and really reaching a lot of people so far.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you both so much. Oh, Kristen has something else?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing that we're trying to accomplish here is to really prevent people from starting smoking, young people. Most people become habitual smokers under the age of 20. But if Michael's story has moved you and you want to try quitting smoking, and, you know, it may take more than one try, please call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
That sounds great. So thank you both for the work that you're doing. And, Michael, thank you so much for going out in the schools and sharing your story in the hopes that it will prevent hopefully dozens and hundreds of people from going down the same path that you're walking right now.
Thank you again for giving me another opportunity.
Yeah, anytime. All right, thank you so much.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. Winter is the season of waterfowl, when ducks and geese flock to our ponds, lakes, and bays. So let's take a moment to celebrate one of our best-known waterfowl.
With his sleek white feathers and big orange bill, Donald Fauntleroy Duck was first sighted in Hollywood in 1934. Despite nearly 40 years on the big screen and more than 150 films and countless comic books to his credit, Donald's plumage has never changed. He still wears the same blue sailor suit without pants. Donald doesn't migrate, but resides year-round in Duckburg, except when a Disney adventure beckons. To our knowledge, longtime sweetheart Daisy has never made Donald a father. But he shows a strong paternal instinct for a trio of unruly nephews, and his friendships extend beyond birds to other vertebrates, such as his colleagues Mickey and Goofy.
Gosh.
Donald is famously temperamental, and even a bit lazy. He means well, but tends to get in over his head. But stubborn and committed, he somehow overcomes the odds. And that, perhaps, is why he's still loved after all these years. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Never likes an argument. Who never shows a bit of temperament. Who's never wrong but always right. Who'd never dream of starting a fight. Who gets stuck with all the bad luck. No one but Donald Duck.
KTOO is the listening artists who wish to contribute works in all mediums that relate to the historic pump house at Sandy Beach for a show at the station in February 2014. The February show will be part of a month-long celebration of the structure, highlighting its history as well as its future. Artists are invited to submit work for consideration ready to hang by Monday, February 3rd, for a first Friday show on February 7th. For more information, contact Jeff Brown at 463-6425 or jeff@ktoo.org.
Jeff Brown, he's here in the studio with us. He's the producer and engineer of the show. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's 3:42 p.m. It's Juno afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Wow, that was such a great interview we just had with Michael Patterson, who's out there telling a story to kids throughout Alaska about not smoking. So that was really, I think, one of the highlights of my time as a volunteer host here. And next up, more highlights. Big Brothers Big Sisters, they're a regular on the show. We've got Joe Clark. Hi, Joe Clark from Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Yeah, hi, Joan.
Hi, what's your official title over there?
They call me the program specialist.
Oh.
I mean, it kind of means I just meet people, match them up, and check in with them to see how things are going.
Okay, so Ian Nico is here as well. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
He and his wife are a Big Brothers Big Sister couple, and we're going to talk about his experience. But before we do that, let's just say, Joan, somebody doesn't know what Big Brothers Big Sisters is. Can you give us the 411?
Yeah, so we are an organization here. We are located downtown. We match up mentors with kids around Juno for professionally supported relationships. So
okay, and there's all different types. There's the school. I'm a school-based
yep.
big sister.
Mm-hmm.
So you meet once a week in the school. There's Big Brothers Big Sisters where you meet outside of school.
That's right.
And there are big couples. Is that
yeah,
what they call
yeah. them? we're hoping to get that word out that couples can be matched together in both the community and the school-based programs. So.
Okay, so Ian, tell me how you and your wife got into being a Big Brothers Big
sure.
Sister couple.
Well, we moved out to Juno in November of last year, or October, and I think we saw a sign somewhere, and we both had this thought in our head that we'd really like to give back, but we'd like to, just really like to give back. We didn't really want any children of our own, but we wanted to work with other children who would benefit and all of us, and so we went and took a visit to Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Great. So, how old is your little brother, little
I
sister?
I think he just turned 10.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And so how does it work? What do you and your wife do with the boy?
Miles is his name. And
mm-hmm. I didn't know if we were supposed to say names, so that's why I said the boy. But okay, so it's Miles.
No. So, and the question was,
what do you guys? You meet weekly with him?
It's 2 to 4 times a month is what they ask. So sometimes, you know, 2, sometimes 3, sometimes 4. There are organized activities every month that Big Brothers Big Sisters puts out. So sometimes we take part in them. Like mm-hmm. there's a couple cooking classes at Thunder Mountain. Mm-hmm. We did that.
Fun.
Made some palminis, I think that's what you call them.
Fancy.
And, some tortilla things. Uh-huh. And we've gone out for bike rides. We've gone to the ice cream shop, the yogurt place here downtown. And, anything outside. He likes to be active, so we try to do a lot of things outside.
Okay, and is it on a regular time? Like, do you?
No, usually weekends. Okay. That seems to work the best.
All right, great. And so how has the experience been for you and your wife doing this? It's over a year now, right?
Not quite. It's been about 8 months.
Okay.
So it's been wonderful, really. I mean, I think we're still taking time in the get-to-know-each-other phase, really. And you know, I think from the first day we met him, when we sat down to sign the paperwork, and he said, wow, this is a big commitment. I don't know if I'm ready to sign on this yet. He kind of endeared us, and we knew we had, we wanted to do it.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm a big sister, too, and this is my second time being a big sister, and I think it's great, too. I think it's really fun. And people go, oh, what do you do? What do you talk about? I'm like, oh, the time just flies. Are you kidding? It's like fun. It's really fun.
Yeah.
And I am a parent, but it's fun to be with somebody who's not your child because the things that you might be concerned with your own child, you're not concerned with this child. You just want to have fun.
Right.
Yeah, right.
You just want to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
So how do people become I'm asking Joe here. How do people become a big brother, big sister?
Well, you could just, give us a call down at our telephone number is 586-3350. Stop on in. Our office is across the street from the Rookery. It's right there.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty centrally located downtown, so
great.
We're open 9 to 4:30 or mm-hmm. 9 to 5, really.
All right. And you have a need for big brothers, big sisters, big couples.
We do, yeah. We have there are a lot of kids waiting, so
okay.
We're hoping to get some more in.
Right. And then, Ian, I feel really supported by the Big Brothers Big Sisters office. Do you feel the same way? That I feel like they're like...
Actually, that was quite a surprise. We get a phone call often from Sheila.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Checking on, and I thought, wow. And my wife and I were just talking about that actually recently. I thought, it's so nice that they call to check in often. You know, you think sometimes maybe they forget about you and do your thing and we'll see you later. But... no, we actually get quite a bit of phone calls to check up on things, and we really like that.
Right. And then the community really supports Big Brothers Big Sisters by these great things that they get to offer for the Big Brothers Big Sisters and the little brothers and little sisters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like Eagle Crest and zip lining and
which
just goes
time.
On and on.
Rock Dump.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. There's a lot of great community.
Okay. So, Ian, do you have any advice for somebody who might be on the fence saying, I'd like to, but should they just... do it.
Find someone to push you off. It is. You know, the more my wife and I kept thinking about it, the more I realized if we don't stop thinking and just go for the plunge, we're just never gonna know.
Right.
And so we thought, let's force them and let's do this. It sounds like a great time and it sounds like a good investment, and it has been. So if you're on the fence and you're thinking about it, I would contact Joe here. I would actually go to the office and talk and get to hear it firsthand, see pictures, see how the organization is run, and that might be enough to put you over.
Sounds great. Okay, no more questions. It's a wrap.
That's right.
Thank you both so much for what you do, Joe.
Thanks,
thank
John.
You for what you were doing. Thank you and your wife for what you're doing. And we're going to be right back. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with our final guest.
press conference with U.S. Surgeon General Richard Carmona on the health hazards from exposure to secondhand smoke.
Secondhand smoke exposure causes heart disease and lung cancer in adults and sudden infant death syndrome and respiratory problems in children.
The debate is over.
Secondhand smoke causes tens of thousands of heart disease deaths each year among U.S. non-smokers.
Brought to you by the Partnership for a Smoke-Free Southeast.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. It's Monday, January 13th. It's 3:51 p.m., and our last guest for the show today is Kate Hudson. She's a board member of Latitude 58. Latitude 58 is a local theater company. They've been around for 2 years. I think they've produced already 4 shows and a radio show, and now they are going into their spring season producing not one, not two, but 3 shows. Is that correct, Kate?
That is correct, yes. We're being fairly ambitious this time.
It's always been very ambitious. I think Seussical, which was the fall production, had something like 60-plus people.
That's right. It had a huge cast, but it was a tremendously exciting and wonderful show that we did at Thunder Mountain High School.
Yes, I heard it was great. I was out of town, but I heard it was really, really great. So this is a theater company for children and adults, is that correct?
That's right. I mean, it started off really as intended to be a children and youth theatre company, but as it's evolved, we've found that families want to get involved too, and that's been a fantastic learning experience for everybody, I think. As a parent, it's pretty cool to be able to participate in an activity with your child.
Right. So. Kate was in a production. She was terrific in it.
That was the best
Christmas pageant ever.
That was,
you,
yes.
Really, I left and I said, wow, you should try out for more plays. You're really good. So what's on the docket for the spring?
Well, we're doing 3 very different shows. First one we're doing is called Sadako and the Thousand Cranes, which is based on a true story. And the play celebrates the courage of a young woman in Japan after the bombing of Hiroshima. And that calls for a cast of about 10 to 20 performers of all ages, including some adult roles. So there's going to be a number of powerful roles for people to play there. Secondly, Janice Hurley is directing a children's ballet called Danger the Dogyard Cat. And that's an account of what would happen if a cat was going to lead a team, an Iditarod team, to victory. And that's going to involve about 15 to 20 young dancers and one older performer to narrate. And in addition to just performing, we're hoping to take that into local elementary schools during the Iditarod as an outreach and educational offering.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. And then finally, The Miracle Worker by William Gibson is a classic of the American theater, which won the Tony for Best Play in 1960. And that's based on the true story of Helen Keller and her teacher, Anne Sullivan. So that's going to, again, is a mixed age cast, and that really offers a lot of challenging performances, opportunities for people.
Okay. So, and these, all these plays are going to be performed in repertory in May.
Correct. It's going to be May 14th to 18th at McPhetus Hall.
Oh, at McPhetus Hall.
Yeah.
Okay. And as far as auditions and orientation, they're coming up, and these are mandatory events if you're interested in participating, correct?
That's right. And they're coming up this week. So if anybody wants to get involved, they have to attend an orientation and information session, which are being held on Thursday and Friday from 6:30 to 7:30 at our rehearsal space, which is in Nugget Mall, and it's opposite where Payless Shoes is situated.
Okay.
And then Saturday all day is the auditions, which sounds daunting. You don't have to prepare anything. You basically show up. You are asked to do some reading. And anybody who shows up and is interested will get a part. So I would encourage anybody who has any interest whatsoever to come along and find out what it's all about. It's just such a fun show, and it's a very inclusive and supportive environment. Our artistic director, Cinnamon Simpson, is wonderful at working with children, and everybody just has a really great time.
Okay, so the mandatory orientation meetings are Thursday and Friday.
Right.
At the Nugget Mall, what time again?
6:30 to 7:30.
Okay, and then the audition process is on Saturday.
That's on Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's in the same space. Bring a lunch. Be prepared to play some fun theater games as well as doing the reading.
Okay. And then as we talked about, there's already been 4 or 5 productions happening already. The theater company has worked with cast of thousands, and people seem to be really, really, really happy with the experience. So is there a fee involved?
There is a fee. The basic tuition for a child above the age of 7 would be $250, but there are some limited scholarship opportunities available. So, and we can provide all that information at the information session on Thursday or Friday.
Okay, and that will also go over rehearsals and so on and so
yes.
forth.
Yeah.
Okay. So, do you think you're going to be trying out for any plays this year?
Well, I'm considering it. I don't think I'll be appearing in the ballet, but yeah. And one other thing I did want to add, actually, was that, and I should have mentioned this, that Seussical was a collaboration with Opera To Go, which was the first collaboration we had done, and it was wonderful for both parties. And we're hoping later in the year to look at some other collaborations as well.
Okay. So we're probably going to have to take a short break and come right back to wrap up the show. But, Kate, if people have some questions, and let's say they want the questions answered before the orientation meeting on Thursday and Friday, is there a website? Is there a phone number?
There is. The website is theatreatlatitude58.com, and our email address is theatreatlatitude58@gmail.com, and that's the best way to get in touch with the theatre. And if somebody is interested in attending and at least finding out more, then please send an email.
Okay.
Yeah.
And even though Kate is from Britain, it's not a British theatre company. It's a Juno Theatre Company. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. I think I'm the only Brit.
So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll go into weather and what's happening here at Juno Afternoon tomorrow.
We've got a new lineup of programs for your Monday evenings on KRNN, starting off with Tidelines at 5 with your hosts Katie Bosler and Marion Call, bringing you an eclectic blend of folk, rock, and singer-songwriters.
I'm the one who's here tonight.
At 7, stay tuned for Doug Learman with a mix of Americana and more. And at 9, the popular concert series Mountain Stage makes its debut on the KRNN airwaves. You'll always find something interesting on listener-supported, community-powered public radio, KRNN-FM.
Okay, the weather for Juno Afternoon. Well, not for Juno, but not for Juno Afternoon, for Juno, Alaska, is strong wind from late tonight through Tuesday morning. Tonight becoming windy, rain developing, becoming heavy at times, rain possibly mixed with snow in the Mendenhall Valley early in the evening, snow level rising to 2,500 feet late, temperatures around 35, slowly rising overnight. Increasing the wind, southeast wind, 5 to 15 miles per hour, increasing 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to around 40 miles per hour late. Tomorrow, windy in the morning. Tomorrow night, numerous rain showers. Wednesday, rain likely. Wednesday night, rain likely. Okay, tomorrow you want to tune in. Scott Burden will be hosting Juno Afternoon tomorrow. He'll be talking to people from the canvas. He'll be talking with poet Emily Wall about her preview of her presentation at the Jack tomorrow night. Also, Havens House matching grant opportunity information and fun details about the Juno Douglas High School production of Spamalot. All that and more tomorrow. Tonight, turn in, 7 p.m., Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Thanks for listening. Next up, All Things Considered.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201.